WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last night at the presidential debate, Gene Gibbons asked a question about a subject the candidates had not been addressing, the banking crisis. Gibbons pointed out there was little or no mention of the savings and loan crisis in the 1988 presidential campaign, and that crisis ended up costing us billions. He asked the candidates if there's now a commercial bank crisis on the horizon. Here's part of Ross Perot's answer.
Now, if you believe the Washington Post and you believe this extensive study that's been done, and I'm reading it, right after Election Day this year, they're going to hit us with 100 banks. It'll be a $100 billion problem. Now, if that's true, just tell me now.
Well, the Washington Post story that Mr. Perot referred to was co-written by my guest, Jerry Knight, with Susan Schmidt. Jerry Knight has been following the banking crisis for the Washington Post. This latest article predicts that the next president will find himself knee-deep in the S&L mess and facing another potential financial crisis, this time with the commercial banks. So, Jerry Knight, how did it feel to have your article brought up during the debate?
Well, it's good to see that the political candidates are finally recognizing this issue. 4 years ago, we went through an entire campaign with the savings and loan industry burning up, literally, falling apart before our eyes, and no one said a word about it. And finally now, 2 weeks before the election, someone has dared to suggest that the banks are in trouble. It's good to see that it's actually being attacked after all these years and months and weeks of neglect.
Well, your article discusses a commercial banking crisis in the works when a new regulation goes into effect December 19th, a regulation that will probably close a lot of banks. What is this new regulation?
It basically tightens the government's control over failing banks. In the old days, we waited for a bank to run out of money, to go broke, before we shut it down. Now the government has decided to step in a little before it reaches the brink. The idea is to minimize the cost to the taxpayers of cleaning up failed banks. That new regulation goes into effect in December. And as of right now, there are about 100 banks and S&Ls that don't meet the standards that they'll need to meet to stay open after that date.
Does this sound like a good regulation to you?
Oh, sure. It's a great idea. One of the mistakes in the past was waiting too long to close banks. So the Congress 2 years ago decided on a strategy called early intervention. The idea is to try to minimize the disruption to the borrowers and the savers when a bank fails. And that's a lot easier if you can step in before it's totally dead and bankrupt.
So how many banks are expected to close and how many states do you think will be affected?
The current list is there are, as of the 1st of July, 86 banks that don't meet the new standard. There are also about 20 S&Ls that don't meet it. Most of those banks happen to be concentrated in a few states, Texas, Massachusetts, California, and Missouri. Some people are suspicious that those are also states with a lot of electoral votes, but I think the banking industry explanation is that those are states where there are banking problems that just haven't been recognized and dealt with.
Are these big banks, small banks?
By and large, they're not big banks. There's really only one big bank on the list. It's in Texas. It's failed once. It's called First City of Houston, and it's been on everybody's problem bank list for about the last 3 or 4 years, and that's not a surprise. Most of the other banks are smaller banks, and I mean in the 100 to 500 million in deposits range.
So is this going to be as bad as the S&L crisis?
No, as both of President Bush and Governor Clinton said last night, this is not in the same scale so far as the S&L crisis. We had about 1,000 S&L failures over the last 4 years, and the bank failure rate will not be nearly that great.
Is it coincidence that the date this regulation goes into effect is after the election?
Well, you have trouble convincing people that it's a coincidence because of the politics involved. But I really think it is. The effective date was chosen at the time the law was passed. Congress said the law goes into effect 2 years after it's signed. The legislation really got stalled in Congress for about 6 months. I think it was originally envisioned that the signing date would have been sometime in the summertime. As it happens, it comes right after the election. And given the way politicians have buried the S&L issue, I think it's reasonable for voters to ask questions about whether they're trying to bury the bank issue. And the political questions are certainly understandable.
Let's look at some of the comments the presidential candidates made last night in reference to the question that was put to them about the banking crisis. Both Clinton and Bush said that they thought the banking system was basically sound. Do you agree with that?
Well, it's sound because we have very low interest rates right now. If interest rates were up 4 or 5 points, the banks would be in big, big trouble. As long as rates stay down, the banks can make a lot of money. They do that simply by not lowering the rates they charge on loans as much as they've lowered the rates they charge on deposits, so that in essence the banks are able to make money off their loans and cover up some of their previous mistakes.
Is that one of the reasons why the interest rates are so low now, to help the banks?
Most people believe that one of the reasons why the Federal Reserve has pushed down interest rates is to help the banks. The idea of lower interest rates is to stimulate economic activity, and certainly one of the direct beneficiaries is the banks. But consumers pay for that.
How do we pay for that?
Well, we think most of us have mortgages. We think of ourselves as big borrowers. But in fact, American families save a lot more than they borrow. And so we're saving on the one side. We're paying lower interest rates on our mortgages and our car loans and to a small extent on our credit cards. But we're earning much less money on our savings accounts. And this is particularly a problem for the elderly. The elderly are really paying a very large cost of rebuilding the health of the banking system.
Because they live on their savings,
and their savings aren't generating much interest. And the savings that were getting them 8% a few years ago are getting them 3 or 4 or 5.
Yet President Bush last night said that the elderly were really helped by low interest rates because they're not facing inflation anymore.
It's true that the lack of inflation helps consumers, but often the trade-off of interest rates and inflation benefits us. There were years during the 70s in which inflation was pretty high, but rates were pretty low, and you were better off borrowing money. Right now, that's not the case.
Now, last night, President Bush said that we need to pass financial reform legislation that modernizes the banking system, doesn't put a lot of inhibitions on it, and protects the depositors through keeping the FDIC sound. What reform is he referring to?
Well, the Bush administration 4 years ago announced a very broad plan to modernize the banking industry. They would permit pretty much unlimited interstate banking, so banks could go anywhere. They would permit banks to broaden their services they offer to consumers, so that instead of giving you just a savings account and a checking account, they might sell you securities or mutual funds or help you invest in, do more retirement planning. That idea got nowhere in Congress. The small banks are adamantly opposed to interstate banking, and the securities industry and the insurance industry are opposed to letting banks get into their businesses. So the politics, the reality of the politics in Washington is that comprehensive bank reform isn't going anywhere, hasn't been going anywhere for the last 4 or 5 years.
Would the kind of reform that Bush is proposing be helpful to consumers?
It would help some consumers. It would help some banks. But there are many people who believe that comprehensive bank reform isn't going to solve all the industry's problems. Little banks don't benefit much from this, and of the 12,000 banks in this country, 10,000 are small banks, and they have no interest in branching into other states or selling insurance or becoming stockbrokers. It would help the big banks. Now, the advantage of this is it's the big banks that, by and large, are in most of the serious trouble.
Governor Clinton said he thinks the banking industry itself should pay for the cost of any bank failures. The taxpayers shouldn't pay. He said, that will be my policy. Exactly what would be his policy, do you know?
Well, that's exactly the policy of the Bush administration and the policy that Congress has adopted so far. The idea is that the Treasury Department is going to lend the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation enough money to handle the expected bank failures in the next few years. And the plan is that that loan will be repaid by the banks, that they will pay higher insurance premiums to the FDIC to make up for the losses. The question everyone has is whether the banks can do that, whether the banks will make enough money and will be healthy enough to repay the loan. There's considerable debate in Congress about that. There are many Democrats, including Henry Gonzalez, the chairman of the House Banking Committee, who thinks the banks simply won't be able to pay the loan and the taxpayers are going to get stuck with the tab, just as they've been stuck with paying for the S&L bailout.
Now, Perot said the whole problem came up in 1984 when the president was told the bailout would cost $20 billion. Perot said, I believe the vice president, Bush at the time, was in charge of deregulation. What was Bush's role during the Reagan administration in deregulating the banks or in decisions that led to the savings and loan crisis?
Bush chaired something called the Deregulation Task Force during the time he was vice president, and that task force promoted relaxing government regulations on a broad variety of industries. Banking was one of them. So the president has some, President Bush has some responsibility. In retrospect, though, no one has ever been able to say that President Bush pushed a particular program in bank deregulation. He generally advocated deregulation in sort of a broad sense. Now, Perot is also correct in saying that the problem could have been solved in 1984. Both Democrats and Republicans wanted to do that, but the idea just couldn't get through Congress. Congress rejected spending that kind of money because they were unwilling to get involved in the problem, and they didn't believe it was that serious.
Now, Perot also said, "Tell me what I owe now. Don't bury this till after the election." What do you think the reasons are that each party has decided not to bring this up during the elections?
This, I think, is a no-win issue for any politician. The taxpayers are unhappy about the S&L bailout. It's costing them about $300 billion. Congress hates the idea of spending that money, but they have no choice. And they don't want to talk about it. Bush doesn't want to talk about it because his son Neil was the director of a failed savings and loans that's going to cost the taxpayers about $1 billion. Governor Clinton has seen a number of S&Ls in Arkansas fail. He got a small loan from one of them. And more importantly, the Democrats are afraid of the issue because it was the Democrats in Congress who could have done something about this during the 80s and didn't want to touch it because some of their old party leaders were involved in the issue. Jim Wright, the former Speaker of the House, was up to his eyeballs in it. We have the Keating Five, in which five senators, four of them Democrats, helped out one of the most notorious people in the savings and loan industry. And Democrats are just scared to death of this issue, too.
The Resolution Trust Corporation is managing the savings and loan bailout. Now, I believe the RTC, the Resolution Trust Corporation, ran out of money last April. How did it run out of money?
Well, they simply spent it. Congress has been doling out the money to pay off depositors in failed S&Ls very slowly and very reluctantly. Last spring, the FDIC got to the bottom of the barrel. They came back to Congress and said, "Hey, we've got a lot of S&Ls out here that are failing. We've promised to protect their depositors. We need a few more billion dollars." And Congress, in an extraordinary act, said no. A group primarily of conservative Republicans led by Newt Gingrich said, "We're not going to vote this money." And it was the Republicans who blocked the administration's efforts to get this dough back. Now, the Democrats had their share of this. The Democrats simply said, "We're not going to step up to the plate and provide this money if the Republicans won't do it."
Why not?
They don't want to take the blame. Nobody wants to vote for this. The politicians don't see providing money for the RTC as protecting the depositors in failed institutions. They see it as paying for the S&L bailout. And so they avoid dealing with it at all costs. They know that eventually the government is going to have to do this. But in an election year, no one wanted to say, "Well, I voted to spend $30 billion on those S&L crooks." No one wanted to be blamed for that, so they simply didn't vote the money. The result of that is that right now, the S&L bailout's pretty much on hold. Occasionally, the government will take over a struggling institution, but instead of shutting it down and paying off the depositors, they have to keep running it because they don't have the money to pay off the depositors.
So what does it mean, that we're going to owe more money in the long run?
Oh, sure. The official calculation now is that the cost of the S&L bailout goes up by $2 or $3 million every day just because of the delays. RTC has needed money since last spring, so we've probably wasted $500 million just waiting for this thing to be dealt with.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jerry Knight, and he's been covering the banking crisis for The Washington Post. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jerry Knight, who's been covering the banking crisis for The Washington Post, and it was one of his articles that Ross Perot referred to last night when he was responding to the question about the banking crisis. What do you think the relevance of this banking crisis issue should be for American voters?
Well, we should be concerned about it because the weak condition of the bank is holding back economic growth. Banks can barely afford to make loans. They've lost so much money on bad real estate and other unwise investments that they can't really give the kind of loans to small businesses that are needed to get the economy growing again. And a weak banking system will hurt our whole economy for a long time to come.
What about the amount of money that American taxpayers are paying? How much are we footing the bill for the banking crisis?
Well, so far, we're not paying directly in taxes, but we're paying it in subtle ways. The premiums that banks pay for FDIC insurance on their deposits really get passed on to consumers. That premium has gone from a couple of cents for every $100 of deposits to 28 cents for every $100 of deposits. And the banks recover that by paying you a little less interest on your checking or your savings account, or charging you a little more interest on your loans. So that directly goes on to consumers. And the weak condition of the banks encourages them to try to rebuild their profits by charging higher rates. And we see that. Look at credit card rates. They've come down a couple of points at the most at a time when other interest rates are way, way down. So consumers are certainly footing a lot of the bill.
So we're paying for it with a little less interest in our savings account, and we're also paying for it in higher interest with our credit cards.
And even consumer loans, car loans, mortgages, the rates on all those loans are a little bit bigger because of the trouble the banks are in.
So with a commercial banking crisis a possibility now, how much money does the FDIC have to bail out banks that might close?
Well, the FDIC is essentially broke. It has about $6 or $7 billion in the bank, but that money is committed for banks they know are going to fail. The Congress has given the FDIC the right to borrow from the Treasury Department up to $30 billion. And once this next round of bank failures is over, they'll start borrowing from the Treasury. And that's our money.
When you say the money in the Treasury is our money, what does that mean?
Well, when the FDIC runs out of money, they'll start borrowing from the U.S. Treasury. And that the taxpayers have put that money in, so the taxpayers will be at risk if the banks can't repay that loan.
Now, we're not going to get a bill in the mail that says bank crisis.
No, it's going to be just like the S&L crisis. You're never really going to know what hit you, but it'll be in your taxes. We're all going to be paying higher taxes for the next 20 years to pay for the S&L bailout. We gave the S&L industry about $300 billion to cover the losses of depositors' money caused by bad decisions by S&L executives. And that money goes into our tax bill. It makes the federal deficit bigger, and it forces the government to charge us more in taxes.
Does this mean that the middle class is going to be taxed one way or another, no matter what the candidates claim?
We're paying for this no matter what the candidates claim.
The immediate issue for all of us, I think, is if there is a commercial banking crisis, will my bank be one of the banks that fails? How can we make the right prediction on that and know what to do with our money?
It is tough. Every time we write a story about the condition of the banking industry, we get phone calls from concerned citizens who want to know what to do about their money. And my advice to them is remember that there is supposed to be a $100,000 limit on federal deposit insurance. And if you have money in a bank, be sure you don't have more than $100,000 in one account, and you'll be protected. The system for handling bank failures is amazingly efficient. I happen to have money in a credit union that failed. I didn't know it until 2 weeks after the fact. Often what happens when a bank fails is that the government will step in on Friday afternoon. They'll close down the ATM machines for the weekend. They'll reopen the bank on Monday morning, and that's it. If you wrote a check over the weekend, it went through. If you had money in the bank on Friday, it's there probably in a new bank on Monday. And the dislocation is very minimal. Usually it's just the lack of the cash machines being closed down for the weekend. In that system, depositors don't have an awful lot to worry about.
So you think that as long as you have less than $100,000 in your account and as long as you're at a bank that's FDIC insured, you'll be okay?
Exactly right. There are very, very few uninsured banks left in the country. Essentially, we have mandatory deposit insurance for just about everybody. And it's one of the great social programs in this country that works. It goes back to the Depression. If we hadn't had deposit insurance over the last 10 years, all these bank and S&L failures would have destroyed our economy.
I guess that's what separates the crises that we're in now from the Depression.
It is, exactly right. Deposit insurance works. Now, many people believe deposit insurance is part of the blame because it's put a lot of money into weak institutions. But the reality for most consumers is that deposit insurance lets you sleep at night. You know your money is going to be safe. And it minimizes this enormous disaster, and is really one of the reasons why it's not a political issue.
Some people say that the FDIC in its own way helped create the savings and loan crisis. Because savings and loans knew that they were insured, they could play fast and loose with depositors' money, and they lost immense amounts of money in making the wrong gambles.
That's certainly true, but it's also true that without federal deposit insurance, the savings and loan failures and the bank failures over the last 4 or 5 years would have been an economic disaster for this country. It would have been as bad as the Great Depression. We've had almost 2,000 financial institutions fail in the last 5 years. If you can imagine what would have happened if all those millions and millions of depositors had lost money, and think of what kind of shape the economy would be in, it would be quite different than it is now. This is a disaster in the sense that it's going to toss the taxpayers a lot of money, but 2,000 unmitigated bank failures would have brought our economy into a terrible depression.
Are there lessons that we should have learned from the savings and loan crisis that we can start applying to the smaller financial crisis on the horizon in commercial banks?
Well, one of the lessons certainly was to be very cautious about deregulating financial institutions and letting them get into new lines of business. We told the SNLs in the early 80s that they could get into the commercial real estate business, and it was a total disaster. They lost billions of dollars because they didn't know that business very well. And many people are reluctant to go along with President Bush's idea of letting banks get into securities and insurance because they fear they'll be inexperienced in the business and will lose a lot of money. The other lesson we should learn is that when problems like this in an industry crop up, the government needs to move very quickly. I think that lesson has been learned, and that's why you're going to see this big batch of bank failures right after the first of the year.
What's the next step for you in covering this? What are you looking at for your next big story?
Well, we're waiting to see what's going to happen in December when this new law goes into effect. The betting is that Uncle Sam will not be Uncle Scrooge and will not start closing any banks down the week before Christmas. But probably right after the 1st of January, you'll see a very large number of bank failures. My estimate is that there will be 100 bank failures during the first 100 days of the new administration. The question then is whether that revitalizes Congress and gets them thinking about what to do about this problem.
Jerry Knight is a reporter for The Washington Post. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.